Welcome to Dentology, the Business of Dentistry podcast. In this podcast, we delve into the non-clinical aspects of dentistry with inspirational guests from across the profession. You will hear incredible life stories, pick up valuable business tips, and be entertained. I'm Andy Acton, and I'm joined by my co-host, Chris Drevens.
Just going right back to the beginning, I thought it would be quite nice why we actually started doing Dentology podcast.
I think, was it because we had nothing else to do?
We had loads to do. We always had. We wanted to share people's life stories.
We did.
People are always fascinating, and it's amazing how people often think they don't have a story to tell. But the reality is they do. Everybody's interesting.
I must admit, every one of the podcasts is fascinating. Yeah. Because everybody tells us about, we all know the stuff you see, don't you? But it's the stuff, their stories about
what
made them who they are, how they got to it. I think that's the fascinating thing about it. That's why I love doing them.
Yeah. And we've never had to push getting business tips, because the business tips just naturally fall out of their story.
Definitely.
And our last objective was to have fun.
I was going to say, I think we have so much fun.
My goodness, we've certainly ticked the box on fun.
And even our guests say that too.
Yeah, it's been great fun.
It's been good.
People talk a lot about resilience, don't they? Do you remember that conversation we had with Kish and Jin?
The Kish and Jin thing, I thought was brilliant, because that moment when they realised that they hadn't passed and they were on a different board was brilliant.
Yeah.
Because it just goes to show that what you see now is not necessarily what it was.
Absolutely. Key moment in that episode.
Yeah.
Really was.
I mean, that time, we can look back at it now and sort of say, look, it worked out well, but it was a scary time because, I mean, I was probably going down the route of not getting through university. I mean, we'll go through later on, but I spent most of my university partying and DJing in clubs and stuff. But when the finals results, I mean, the finals year was when all our sort of topics came together and we were on clinics more, and we loved it. And we actually did fairly well on the written papers. And it was on one case that we both failed on. Yeah. And at King's College back then, we had about 220 students in our year, which is a lot of students. And the results will go up on the wall for everyone to read. So we all had to walk down. And those of you who went to King's College, New Hunt's house, on the board, they'll put all the results. And you have to find your name. And myself and Kish were there with everyone else looking for our name. And we couldn't find it. And down the hall, right down the hall, someone shouts out, "Jin, your name's down here." And I thought, this might be a special board. I might have a distinction. Honorary member of, Kings, they're going to put a statue up of me. And I ran down and I was on the failure list. And getting that, and it was hard. I'm not going to lie, it was hard when we got it. Especially because of, seeing our parents work so hard and the pressure. My dad, typical Indian dad, Asian dad, son, you can only be, a doctor, dentist, or a failure. I know I succeeded in the third one.
Can I ask you what was your dad's reaction when you said, was he like, it's okay, you can try harder next time or whatever?
I kid you not. And this, those who know, Asian parents, especially dad, that's the most thing I was scared of. Going home, dad will be ready with some weapon, whether it's a flip-flop. And I got him, I told him what's happening. He goes, "Okay, that's fine. You just put your head down and do it again." And when he turned around to me, and I was like, damn, I just have to push hard now. And then when the results were there, I remember reading my name, and then right below mine,
who's your best friend?
Dr. King. he just thought, because I've pretty much passed every year. Jin was not the same. Okay, I think Jin, you failed first year.
No, we were always top three. King was in the top three from the top. I was in the top three from the bottom. So we were always doing well.
So, Jin decided to drag me down with him. Just a bit.
That's right. Blame Jin.
6 months. But no, look, on a serious note, one thing I have to say is that as much as we joke about sort of the pressures of Indian parents and this, that, and the other, the support that we got, saying, look, don't worry about it. Things happen in life that are beyond your control. But as long as you learn from this and you go on and you push and you keep growing. That was one thing that, you know, my grandmother said to me when I told her the news, because, you know, it's one of those things that they always look out for, that sort of your past. You become a dentist. You think you go through 5 years of university life. It's always going to be, you're going to qualify. Mm. There's not going to be any hiccups along the way. Unfortunately, that's not how it goes always. You know, there's always going to be hiccups.
But having that structure and system to encourage you and motivate you and build you up, but also being that safety net and catching you when something doesn't go well, that's strong families, isn't it? Yeah. You know, and that thing that, you know, that trepidation of going back to your respective parents and saying, like, it didn't go well. But strong families in those moments, that's when they kind of get their arms around you and say, it's fine, it's all right. You know, worse things can happen. And I've always learned a lot more from failure from success anyway. I think when something goes wrong, you really reflect on what happened and you come out of it so much stronger. And in a weird way, you know, failure is perhaps a harsh word, but something not going well early on probably helped you really think more critically about the things that you're going to do going forward and make sure that you had all the foundations in place for it to go well. So.
Talk about driven. What was he? World champion kickboxer and he's a man who never seems to fail anything he puts his mind to. He is so driven,
focus is insane. And that comparison with Marcus Waring, the chef, was just insane. Great episode.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's a lot of similarities there. I think it is probably a combination of obviously the city that we grew up in. You know, people from Liverpool tend to be quite ambitious. We're authentic within ourselves, and that sometimes makes us sort of quite unique in so many ways to go out and want to do better and work hard. And I think the martial arts and the boxing background, if that's in you from a very young age, it just develops this sort of mentality, this certain discipline within you, which becomes a normal part of your life, which, you know, to me, you know, the drive, the work ethic is completely normal, but only when you reflect or when other people bring it up that you really sort of start to realize that it is quite different. And as you mentioned on that podcast, that comes out quite uniquely in his story as well, really. So I can see the similarities, definitely, yeah.
Yeah. And did you started boxing young, didn't you?
Yeah, I was going to ask you, when did you start?
Six.
Oh, wow.
Eight, six, yeah.
And you weren't just a good boxer, were you? You know, I've from what I understand, you were a pretty good. Weren't you something like world champion or something?
I started. Yeah. It was kickboxing that I was involved in from the age of six. It was a massive part of my life for 20 odd years. Traveled the world competing, really, and yet managed to attain numerous world titles as a junior and as a senior.
And that's nuts, isn't it? I mean, I love the modesty of I did a bit of boxing. A bit of boxing's me in my garage.
but also I imagine the sacrifice that your parents must have made, because when you're that young, you know, I played racket sports as a kid, nothing like to that level. But I had a massive appreciation that my father, most weekends, meant that we had to get packed up in the car, we had to drive off around the country to play in competitions. And I guess there was a sacrifice from your parents' side of things to support you to that level.
Absolutely, yeah, exactly the same. You know, most weekends, my dad and myself would travel the country competing in competitions. So because I was competing at quite a high level, obviously we had competitions that we would attend as a club, but we always did more. You know, there'd be competitions everywhere. My instructor hated us traveling south. Yo used to get a bad deal. I used to travel, just me and my dad. We'd travel literally up and down the country every weekend, really, and compete, go into the Lions Den all the time. And it's just to get fights under our belts more than anything, and just constantly strive for improvements. And I owe a lot to my dad for that, because he did dedicate endless hours. My dad worked shifts at the time. So sometimes in the week I wouldn't see him if he was working nights or whatever shifts he was. My mum would be taking me to the gym. My mum used to hate taking me to the gym. She literally couldn't watch.
Oh, really?
I think that's mum's for you, isn't it?
Yeah. And then over weekend, most weekends, as I say, I would compete, and my dad would sort of drive me all around the country. And it all started.
Were you boxing, doing training to be a dentist as well?
Well, that came much later. So those years were when I was like, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11, right into my teens. As I got a little bit older in my teens, 14, 15, 16, my dad was always with me, but then obviously I was traveling myself to training and stuff. I remember specifically one summer holiday, I was 16, and my instructor put me in the adult world championships a year early, because I'd won all the junior titles, and he told me to go into the adult a year early. And that whole summer holidays, I say my dad was working for the whole 6 week summer holiday. The world championship was like, I think it was the first week in September. Three times a day I was training. I had to get three buses to go. We were training a local cricket club. That's where we're having all our sessions, apart from the evening session, which was in our gym. But we're training at 9 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and then 6 p.m. in the evening. And I had to get three buses twice. So we had to get three buses there for the 9 o'clock session, three buses back, 11. I'd eat, have a little nap, three buses back. And that was my whole summer holiday after just finishing my GCSEs, I think. So it basically didn't get
a holiday. When everyone else is out partying.
Yeah, it was literally.
You're still having to do the exercise.
It was literally that level of commitment.
I really enjoyed the episode with Kunal Patel of Love Teeth as well, because he didn't have an easy start at all, did he?
No, I tell you what, I had no idea about that. You know, going to the Czech Republic, where you don't speak Czech.
Yeah,
and it's not easy. Then having to go, I mean, what was it when you turned up? There was no sort of a hostel where nobody really communicated, said to build his own community to grow from.
But out of that came a real sense of responsibility and drive from that hard start.
Yeah, definitely.
Really interesting story.
The show, doesn't it? Your backgrounds and what brings out.
Absolutely.
I didn't get the grades that I wanted to at A-levels, so I decided to do fast track through doing a BSc to go into medicine. So I went to Queen Mary's for a year. I did biochemistry. It ended and I was like, this is mind-numbing. I hated it, right? And then a younger cousin of mine finished his A-levels and he didn't do it as bad as me, but he just got into pharmacy and he wanted to do dentistry. So we were over HL's house, opened the newspaper, and it said, become a dentist in Prague. And turned to me. So I went, great, dentist in Prague. And at that time, Prague was known as the stag capital of the world. And that's all I knew of it.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I was like, come on, cuz, let's go do this, right? I go, mum and dad will buy us a degree and we'll get drunk at the same time and see what this is all about. And it was far from the truth. So we landed in Prague airport around 5 p.m. It was still daylight. This little minibus picked us up with a sign saying our names on. We got in and it drove for about 2.5 hours and it didn't stop. We're like, how big is Prague, right? And then all of a sudden we're outside this sort of hostel. And they give us some keys and say, this is the room. See you later. Someone will be in touch. And we're like, what, really? Now, you know, we come from good families where our parents, you know, we've been sheltered. You know, the good spoilt kids, the standard Gujarati spoilt boy, you know. Never did laundry, never fended for myself. Everything was given to me.
No.
So all of a sudden we had to learn how to cook, had to wash our clothes. But more importantly, survive, right? We cried for about a week straight because we were locked in this room and that movie Hostel came out that year. And it was literally the same. The toilet, bath and sink were all in the same thing, right? Like there was a sink was in the bath. So you had to get in the bath to brush your teeth. It was weird. And the toilet's right next to you.
Oh, wow.
So mum and my uncle came to sort of settle us in. They couldn't believe how bad it was. Then they tried to settle us in. But then over the coming week, a few more of us rejects, spoiled kids, got dumped at this place, right? So we formed a little community. And then the university.
They've actually turned this into a reality TV show now, haven't they? Don't they do this in real life? And they've
really? People. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It sounds like they want Big Brother.
But
yeah, and it was literally like, okay. And then as more of us got there, my parents left, we cried, We still remember it. We're hugging each other, crying. They've gone. And then it became okay because we created a community. It was okay. But there was about 150 of us in our first year. In the final year, I think there was about 7 of us graduated. So, wait. So.
And were those 150 from all across Europe?
Yeah, so international. So majority of us from the UK, and there was a big Scandinavian community as well. And because apparently it was cheaper to educate them outside of Norway than within Norway. So the government would fund for the education in the Czech Republic. We didn't realize how strict this university was. So we're in this town called Hradec Králové. It's more than 2 hours away from Prague. It's got nothing for entertainment. They haven't really ever seen brown people like me. And the only ones that they've seen, they've had bad impressions of, which were known as the thieves and the gypsies around that area. So we spent the first few years getting beaten up quite often by the locals. You'll get on.
Oh, really? What? Yeah. Just race? Just
Like, Prague was used to foreigners, whereas these villages were. Yeah. We were the first year to do dentistry. So it was a medicine uni for international students, but not for dentistry. So we more or less learned medicine for the first few years and just did a bit of dentistry at the end. So my qualification is actually MUDR, which is a medical doctor with dentistry. So we did a lot more medicine dentistry.
Interesting.
So in terms of dental skills, when I left university, wasn't the best. Did a couple of fillings and handful of extractions. But what it was really, really good at was book knowledge, textbook knowledge. So literally there wasn't a single exam that was written. Everything was like a viva oral exam in English, but you had to be able to speak, read and write Czech within the first 2 years. And that's why by the end of it, only, I think there was about 5 or 6 of us that graduated in my final year. Out of 150. Yeah. So in terms of when I think about it now and people say, could you do it again? Probably not, because the number of times me and my cousin, you know, were walked up to the bridge, Charles Bridge, the famous bridges out there. And you know, beautiful. We're letting our parents down. And, you know, I joke about it now, but at the time it was serious. Like, you know, parents are paying £10,000 a year for tuition fees. You know, are we going to get through it? It was so hard, so difficult. You know, there's many times that we thought, let's just end this. And now thinking back, it was probably the best thing that happened to me, but could I have done it again? I don't think I can. I don't know how we did it. I think, you know, when you're a lot younger, you're not so aware of what you're doing. You're just doing it.
Naivety in lots of scenarios is not a bad thing, because if you fully knew everything that was coming at you or you had more information, you might not do it.
And was your cousin one of the 7?
No. So he actually failed one of the years. So he graduated the year after me.
Right.
So,
right.
You know,
but it sounds to me, I was going to say, it sounds to me like you learned a lot more than just dentistry out there.
Yeah, it was.
It made you grow. It made you grow up. In
you know what I say. I wouldn't, you know, the person that you've met now, that wasn't the guy that left and went out there. So when I came back and my old school friends, you know, got to know who I was, I mean, some of them are still baffled how I've ended up on the BBC. You know, it was a completely different person that left to who came back. I came back with responsibility. I felt as if I worked so hard for that degree, I was going to make the most of it in every possible way. And it gave me that drive.
I love the episode with Indy Johal.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely incredible. The sacrifice that her family made for her was quite remarkable.
Well, it was unbelievable, wasn't it? You know, you think she was here and then her parents were busy and they decided that to give her a better education, to send her back to India.
Where she had her first birthday.
Yeah, I say, and how long was she there for? I can't remember. It was a while, wasn't it? And then you've then got to come back again and relearn English and English culture and all that sort of thing. I mean,
what a sacrifice people will make for education.
Yeah.
Great episode.
It was.
I guess, like, my story starts, like, I was born in the UK. I was born in London. And, you know, I was a child of an immigrant, so obviously I didn't have much support in the UK. There wasn't a lot of people to look after me. And my dad used to actually drive a cab back in those days. And he was saying that, you know, my mom used to work at the airport and she'd gone back to work when I was 2 months old because they needed to make money and all of this stuff. And he always says this story to me that one of the days he went, he just dropped into the nursery because he had a cab fare that had come around that way. So he thought, I'm going to pop in, I'm going to see my baby, and then I'll just carry on working. And he said, I came in and you were crying and nobody was looking at you and you looked like you were so distressed. So he said, that's when I just made the decision that you're better off with my parents in India. So I'm going to send you back so they'll actually look after you rather than we just work like crazy hours and you're just with somebody else who's not looking after you. So I went back to India. I had my first birthday in India without my parents, actually. And there's loads of photos from that time where there's loads of food on the table and there's just a photo of my parents in between the samosa and all of this and just me in the background.
Oh, desperate. So, oh, sweet.
A little bit of a different kind of childhood, but you know, I'm so glad to have had that upbringing and that time with like my grandparents and back home. I think it just adds a little bit of something else to your childhood, and I think you have a lot of freedom as a child when you're in kind of like a country like India. You're just roaming around, you're doing your own thing, you can just, you know, get on with the day and do whatever you want. And when I came back to the UK for good, I was around 5 years old. I came back to the UK and I couldn't speak English. I didn't know where I was. My parents, because it had been such a long time since I'd met them and like spent time with them.
And I suppose there's no like WhatsApp or anything like that, or video callings.
Nobody had phones. Yeah. There used to be a phone, like one phone in the village. So it was actually called, the phone booth was actually called an STD, which now, looking at it,
you wouldn't want to be going there, would you?
I don't even know what it stands for. And if that phone would ring, they basically would send one of the local kids running to the house, whoever the phone call was for, and then you would have to run there before the money ran out and speak to whoever it was and then run back home.
Oh, wow.
What's interesting, Indy, I think, the sacrifice that parents make for their children. You know, we've talked to lots of people who their life originated in India and their parents made almost like the reverse sacrifice, that they uprooted the family and decided to come to England. Quite often it was in the 60s or 70s when, you know, it wasn't an easy place to come to because they wanted to build a better life for their kids. Yeah. And it's interesting that the reverse is true for you, that your parents had come to England but found that at that time it wasn't the best place for you to be. But to make that sacrifice to, you know,
to not pass, be your daughter.
Yeah, to pass their daughter back to grandparents in India because actually that was better. And then you come back. I think it's remarkable.
Are you an only child, Indy?
So I'm the eldest. I'm actually the eldest grandchild on my dad's side and the second eldest on my mom's side. So I was like, you know, the prized possession when I went back to India because they hadn't had a baby in the house for such a long time. So everyone was really excited. And I think that's what makes that transition easier, because you get so much love when you're there. So it didn't, I didn't feel like, I don't remember a time where I was thinking like, oh, where are my parents? I don't think I had time to think, where are my parents? Mm. Because there was too many other people there to entertain me and take care of me. But my parents, I think, did find it tough. And my mom says that sometimes, you know, she would like sit and look at the cot and be crying and thinking, what's the point of us being here? Because we don't even have our baby. So, you know, I think for them, it was a massive sacrifice. And if I look at what position they were in, and that's just one of the sacrifices that they made. They came from a very kind of humble beginnings in India, and you know, they didn't have a lot when they were there. They came here with one focus, and that was just to make it. So, you know, how you think of the American dream, this was just the UK dream. They were going to come here, they were going to work hard, they were going to make something of themselves and, you know, establish a base for their future family. So I think for them, that was a massive sacrifice, like one of many that they've made while we've been growing up. So I look at their sacrifices and think, I don't know if I could make the same.
We should go right back to the very, very first episode we did where we spoke to Shaz Memon. Remember, he talked to us about Wales on Wheels.
He did. And the reasoning behind it.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, the fact that with his daughter, he thought about the girls in India and thought about his daughter having to carry water for miles, and
produced that great initiative, which is gathering pace.
He's well on track to be leaving a legacy, which is incredible.
Oh, it is.
Yeah. It was a lovely episode.
Just finally, Sarah, just to wrap up, last question, is legacy important to you?
Yes, it is. I mean, like I said, when I was growing up, I was highly influenced by my brothers. And I want my daughter, Helena, to grow up and see what we're doing, which goes beyond this very materialistic society that we live in, to carry on that legacy. And obviously, I want her to make that choice, but I'm going to leave a very good example. So either she or someone steps up and carries this on and turns it into something. I guess Wells on Wheels will one day turn into an organization which actually champions pipelines for the poor. It could turn into something like that.
Oh, I think you're in a very good place to leave that legacy in place. And if your daughter carries on anything like the work that you started, I think that would be an amazing thing.
Mm. Yeah, you almost want to make Wales on Wheels obsolescent, don't you?
Yes.
In the fact of you've managed to defeat the issue. But at least in the meantime, it's going to be doing something. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
But, you know, I still remember and I appreciate it so much that when I first shared the idea with you, I mean, you didn't even ask how, what, where. You just said, yeah, Frank Taylor and Associates will want to be behind that. And you committed. And those are the sort of things which give me so much strength, because like you've got other friends, like, you know, you're going to be interviewing Harry Ice Connect, and there's lots of other great people out there that will just say, yeah, you know, look, we know you, we're going to back you. And that's what's given me the strength that on difficult days, you don't think, you know, I'm going to leave it, because there's so many people behind you. So thank you very much to you both for being one of my earliest supporters.
Wasn't speaking to Drew Shaw an absolute joy?
Oh, he's a lovely guy.
He's lovely. But his whole thing about having a purpose beyond himself and trying to build a community.
It's his whole ethos. It's almost like his being.
Yes.
He seems so selfless to make sure that there's a community that people can access.
Yeah. And that's how he created Dentinal Tubals. Yeah. Yeah, it was a really good episode.
What's the thing that kind of gets you out of bed hobbling with your Achilles every morning?
What makes me jump out of bed, actually, really? Is it a passionate, you know, passionate demon, or is it demonic passion? And, you know, it's an interesting question, because that experience that I had in dental school put my first vision about education to the world. Nobody should ever, you know, have these challenges. We need to find a way in which everyone has access to education. It's a powerful
tool. Yeah.
But beyond education, there's something else that happened, because I went through all these journeys, you know, part of it after graduating as a dentist. I was a foreign national then, and the UK wouldn't allow me to do what's known as VT, or foundation dentistry as it's known now. And we had to think out of the box again.
That's interesting.
A place called Welshpool, because Welshpool is in mid Wales, because the Welsh Deanery facilitated that. It basically became a case of, you guys need dentists, I need a job, there's a shortage of dentists. Let's sort this out. And there was a group of us who were the first people to get Welsh parliamentary approval to do VT for 2 years. So I remember the Welsh dean sort of picking the phone up to me and saying, you've got the place, but there's a condition. I said, what is it? You'll have to stay there for 2 years. I said, no problem. And you'll have to show evidence of postgraduate education. I said, no problem. You'll pay for my exams. And they agreed that. So I ended up in Welsh. Now, that was fun. 3 amazing years. In the middle of nowhere, I sort of end up in this street, you know, where the Welshpool basically at that point had a population of about 15,000, lots of villages around. The practice itself, 8 surgeries, and it had, I don't know, 30,000 patients on the list, something big, and serving the community. 15 pubs, all sorts of fun things in there. And you know, I just loved the life, made me great. I then came to the UK, to London, sorry, to do hospital jobs after 3 years, did my restorative, etc. jobs, and then going to specialty training in periodontics. And despite the institution, I was at King's College London, guys, having some of the best educators in the world, you know, people who a lot of people admire to or respected, I lost all inspiration in dentistry. I just went, this is too institutionalized. Jesus, people are thinking in the box, I'm out. So after all this journey, I was close to quitting. So that's when I started Tubules. And Tubules connected me with some of the most enthusiastic, energetic, extremely talented dental professionals around the world. And that brought back my zest with dentistry. Mm. Now, so two things that drive me massively now are education to the world. But the second thing that I think has become the flavor is beyond education, helping people find their spark so that that fire is lit in within them. And then it's driven. They're not getting out of bed because there's a fire under their bum. They're getting out of bed because there's a fire in their belly. And if we can help people with that, it just creates that vibrancy.
Talking to Sharon Waxkirch was a real breath of fresh air, wasn't it?
It was. What I loved was the fact that she was bringing something sort of almost unusual and outside into dentistry.
Yeah, new ideas. Yeah, new ideas.
New ideas are brilliant.
Right? Yeah, I think dental hypnotherapy as a concept and as a practice is something I can see coming more and more into dentistry.
Definitely.
Great episode.
Avoid stuff.
Absolutely.
Over here, it's better. Over here.
So it's more accepted here.
Far better acceptance. There are simple reasons for this. If you have on your website hypnotherapy or we offer hypnosis, you're far more likely to get those phobics or high anxiety clients to walk through your door. Because those people realize that no matter what that is going to happen, they know that you are more on board with them mentally and emotionally. Whether they even know what hypnosis means themselves, it doesn't matter. They just know that the dental company has taken their time to kind of understand that people have anxieties and issues.
It acknowledges it. Yeah, the acknowledgement is...
Whereas if you go to the States, I'm where I live, you know, it's sort of like I'm in a very peculiar place. So it's almost like a no, the devil did this. But in other areas of the States, it's trickling in, but very, very slowly.
Wow.
Very slowly. And I think there's another issue in the States compared to the UK. In the States, they're really prepared to give you anesthesia for even teeth cleaning, anything. And they'll start with kids. You know, they'll immediately inject a child to anesthetize their mouth before, so that they don't. And they've got so used to medicating their patients that the idea of not using medication almost seems too mystical. And
go back unusual. In time almost, yeah.
Mm. I suppose it's just built into society that that's how you treat people.
Yeah,
exactly. And over here in the UK, it's still not a thing in such a way. We're not, thank God, we're not sort of overly medicating everybody yet. I say yet because these things do fly over the water.
I really, really love talking to Chinwe. And the thing that struck me about Chinwe was her winding road to success from Nigeria to Italy to England.
Yeah, it's fascinating. That sort of almost having to relocate, reinvent, relearn.
Everything.
It's like, it's mad to go from, as you say, Nigeria to Italy, Italy to England.
Yeah.
How many people have ever done that?
Oh,
but I thought it was really motivational.
Yeah, lovely story.
So I was born in Nigeria. So I lived in Nigeria with my mom and my two sisters. I was there up until the age of 12. So my dad actually lived in Italy. He worked in Italy and he had his family in Nigeria because I think back in the days, like in the 80s and the 90s, things were really good back in Nigeria. So my dad always thought that we were going to be there forever. So he would always sort of commute from Italy to Nigeria during the summer and yeah, that was it. But as the years went by, things just got really, really difficult to manage and he just couldn't cope, you know, with flying in and out and everything. So he just decided, you just have to come over. And even life in Italy was actually cheaper than life in Nigeria because everything had to be private in Nigeria. There was nothing, you know, republic. There were many public schools and everything was just expensive. And basically it was, I mean, I had two sisters, so there were three children, the mom and dad had to look after. Mm. So it was really, really hard. So we moved to Italy. That was in 2004, so 2004. I was just 12 years old there. And I remember, I think I felt a bit upset that I was living in Nigeria because, I mean, that's all I had known. I had all my friends. I was in school. And yeah, it's basically like, you know, getting towards the teenage age. So I was not about going to Italy at all. Even if
whereabouts in Italy?
So I ended up in Brescia. So we lived in a city called Brescia. Brescia is in the northern part of Italy. So for those who watch football, they might not know about the football team. It's very close to like Milano, Bergamo. So whenever you fly to Milano, Bergamo, it's like 45 minutes from there. So it's a small city, not as big as Milano, but quite a big industrial city. So that's where we ended up with our family. And what was that? I didn't want to go, even if it was a better life for me. I think back then I was just 12. So, I mean, my mom and dad knew better. And something I remember, I think that struck me was a comment I think that my dad made when we were coming through was that even in Nigeria, like I feel like life wasn't easy there, but we were used to that. We were used to struggling. And I think I remember asking my dad this question. I asked him if there was like electricity 24/7. And he sort of laughed at me. And he was like, I felt really bad because I feel like my kid has not, because I've never had that. Like we would go days and days without electricity in Nigeria. Like everything was so precious, water, like even the basic necessities of life was really, really hard to get then. So he felt like he was really happy we were coming over. And he said he did feel bad that, you know, his little girl was asking him if there was electricity 24 hours. Is that-
Yeah, real like basic needs.
So it was a good thing. So anyway, we moved to Italy, and as I didn't like it, honestly. My first, I would say, how long, I think, my first 5, 6, 7 years, they were horrible. We ended up in a very small village in Brescia, as I've said already, and we were like the only black family there. So it was something completely, completely new. And in Italy, you don't speak English, so we had to learn Italian. So we started going to school, and they just placed us.
Could your dad already speak Italian? He was
the only one who spoke Italian.
Yeah.
So I, my two sisters, and mom had to start learning Italian. So it was really hard. I'd go to school, I would not understand a single word of what my teacher was saying. I would just sit in class. Sometimes I'd sleep through class because I couldn't just understand anything. I had a few lovely teachers who took their own extra time to give us Italian lessons. Like they knew a little bit of English and would stay back after school, and so we did meet some lovely people, even if child was really hard because the kids were not used to seeing like black people. So when we would get on the bus, no one would sit next to us. It's literally a very lonely kind of. So I think like my teenage, I would never go back in life. I know everyone says, oh, I'd like to go back, to when I like, no, not.
Had your dad prepared you for this? Because obviously your dad had lived over there. Had he just become immune to it? Did he not notice that it was that sort of environment because he was so used to it?
My dad was very protective and he didn't want it to come from, like, he didn't want to sort of skew our thoughts already towards racism. So he was pretending it wasn't there. He knew it was there, but he didn't just want to prepare saying, okay, girls, when you come over, people are going to look at you different, because he felt like by saying that, he was sort of already setting us up. Does that make sense? To feel that we're old.
No, absolutely.
I know it's a really weird concept, but I think my dad sort of like ignored it. He knew it was there, just preferred to not to speak about it, because that way he felt that we would dwell more on it. He would always encourage us and say, you're the best.
But it sets the environment, doesn't it?
I was going to say, were people neutral to you or were they negative to you? You know, were they just like, oh, you're a bit like a, I don't know, almost like something on show, or were they actually unpleasant to you as well? Were they, were they negative?
That's a very good question, I think. So I think according to different phases of our life, when we were younger, they were very negative because I think kids are very direct. As we got older,
they can be horrible, can't they, kids?
Really horrible. Negative when we were like 12, 13, 14, 15. Once we got into high school, I mean, people were more mature. It was more of like indifferent, like we don't even exist. Like, and that was also the same through university for me as well. So, you just become immune to it anyways. But yeah, initially it was a bit more of negativity and also surprise. I would see some kids as well, so just they're really curious. So not everyone was really negative. Some people were just like, I've never seen anyone like this before. You could actually tell. But another thing I felt like was just really not right was the fact that people would always stare at you in such a way that was so inconvenient that you wouldn't even be able to carry on with what you were doing. So I and my family, for example, if we went to the restaurant, everyone would stop eating in the restaurant and everyone would stare at you. And it was ridiculous. You didn't go to the restaurant that often.
The thing is, it's really hard because I've lived in London all my life. So, you know, London is one of the most diverse and multicultural places on the planet. If you stopped and looked at anyone who was slightly different to you, you'd get nothing done. Yeah, because you literally would get nothing done because there's...
In a restaurant.
Well, no, because there's so many creeds and cultures and different types of people. So it's remarkable to think that people in a restaurant would literally stop and look at you based on the colour of your skin. It's remarkable.
I mean, it makes me laugh now. I look back and I'm like, how? Like, it's just so funny. As you said, especially now I live in London, it's just funny. And I'm like, I can't believe, honestly, but that's how it was for us. But anyways, so we started off at middle school. I and my twin sister, my older sister was a year older. She went straight into high school. I was so lucky I had my twin sister. So we'd go to school every day. So I was never on my own. If she was ill, I wouldn't go to school. If I was ill, she wouldn't go to school. That's how it was, because we could not.
That was your
exactly. So we got really, I mean, we were already close, but I think this experience also like made me and my sisters super, even closer than you can ever imagine. Like everyone says it and they notice it. We're so close. But I think this life experience has made you this way as well.
And I was thinking, as a teenager, those are really formative years, aren't they? You know, and in reality, if you didn't have a circle of friends, and then you're going to be really tight with the sisters, aren't you?
You said it all, as simple as that. Yeah, we had no friends, so everything we did was together. But it was fine. I found out I didn't need friends. I thought I didn't need friends then, because I just felt, yes, that, you know, I had everything I needed, because luckily there was three of us, you know, so we were already a group. So it was three of us. If we wanted to go out, it would be three of us. So three is a good group, you know, it's not. I mean, it's
adding two,
so it was okay.
Yeah.
So,
what I wonder whether that's another, you know, a lot of these the podcasts we do, there's always something, isn't there, that we go, oh, I wonder if that has helped. And it's, I'm just thinking, I wonder if that experience has made you as self-sufficient as you are, in the fact of you've got your tight group, so it doesn't, but you've spent your teenage years not really caring about what other people think or whatever, mixing, and you can choose to engage or not engage depending on whether you want to engage or not engage.
Yeah. I have to compliment you, because I think you just hit the nail on the head. That is so true. I'm not saying I don't care, but I've just, as you said, because it's my formative years. I mean, it's just, as you said, I'm not really bothered about trying to like fit in, you know, because I never fit in the first place, and I've just been happy. It's true. So I'm just so happy with my family and my sisters. And as you said, I decide if I want to engage, if I want something.
I think another episode to pick out for me was when we spoke to Lottie Manahan.
Oh, yeah, she's great.
Lottie, Teeth by Lottie on Instagram. But her talking about how green is dentistry.
Yes, yeah. And I loved that one eco tip a day or whatever it is, a week.
Oh, the weekly eco tip.
I thought that was brilliant because everybody could do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, no, it was a real content-rich episode, wasn't it?
Small little things. Like every week, I come up with a tip. So I nominate myself as the eco member at work. And I just basically, everyone at lunchtime today, turn your lights off. You know, it's a whole hour of time. If you've got like 6, 7, 8 surgeries in your practice and you can get 8 hours of light off in that practice, then why not? And it's just these little things of like reminding.
Especially with the price of utilities.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's even economical now, isn't it? I mean, that's the.
It's not.
It makes you wonder whether, because people are intrinsically sort of, you know, there's a selfish and a lazy side to all of us. Whereas if.
It's financial.
Well, I was going to say, if it's just for green's sake, people might not do it. But actually, if people start turning their lights off, which is good for the environment, because of the cost of electricity, it makes you wonder whether there's going to be some side benefits coming out of it. You know, I remember seeing those photographs of, I think it might have been the Venice waterways during lockdown, when there were none of the cruise ships going to St. Mark's Square. You know, you could see how clean the water was. And so there's always these kind of, you know, unusual benefits that come out of different situations.
I mean, it surprises me, yet again, the fact of that people just leave their surgery lights on while you just think when you're at home you'd walk out and turn a light out. So that's true. But it's just, that's another one I'm thinking, cool, you imagine how many surgeries there are, and if that's the norm is to just leave the light on, because actually why bother turning it off? It's just like mad, isn't it?
Yeah, but also with patients as well, it's one of the things that I always put on a reminder is their toothbrush chargers. They keep them plugged in the whole time. And they do
when you don't need to.
Yeah, like that is something that is just wasting away electricity, and also leaving the tap on while they brush their teeth. I mean,
my kids used to tell me that off. they when they were at school, because I would have been a tap on man, and then the kids would come in and say, water waster, water waster. So now I've learnt that you turn the tap off in your teeth.
Yeah,
but that was my kids. That was my kids who influenced me when they were little.
2 minutes of water just going down the plug hole for no reason.
Yeah, for no reason.
But like you say, and it's how you get that message out so that we start to move the dial.
Yeah.
So that enough people start to see those small changes.
That's a small increment. Small increments, isn't it?
Yeah. Wow. It's not all about making these huge changes. It's making small ones. And actually, when you start, it just kind of keeps creeping up and up, and you actually start to enjoy it. I'm a geek with it, so.
But also, I think the smaller changes are so much easier to incorporate into your life. You know, when people start saying we need to do this really big thing, that's quite an ask for lots of people. Whereas things like turn the lights off.
Was that one a week, you said, or one a day? Is it one a week?
As your
green person in this.
Yeah, one a week, really. Yeah.
I mean, flip. I mean, that's quite a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just thinking, how do you think about it? It's 52 a year. Green ideas.
I also have to be calm because sometimes people will try and recycle like paper towels or things that really aren't recycled, and I like watch them do it, and I just think I don't want to be like the recycle police and cause some argument. But what I do is I'll put like a sign. I do like little signs next to the bins and just make sure that it's so easy. But yeah, I do this, and then they'll see me less.
Very polite.
Can I just say that's not very people pleasing?
The books are working.
Yeah, that's funny. One of your books. Yeah.
No, I do have to rein it in sometimes, but that's just
John Nicholas was another episode that really stood out for me as well, and I was really taken by how much he attaches to the power of routines and affirmations and mantras. They really do anchor him.
I thought one of the things, John, was, and I know this sounds possibly a little bit shallow, but I was really surprised that he was so spiritual in his, you know, his meditation.
Yeah.
Day.
Oh, it really matters to him.
It really struck me.
Yeah. Yeah. Striking episode.
There's a guy that I love listening to. He's a guy called Mo Gordat. I don't know if you guys have ever heard him before.
Yeah, the Google X guy.
Yes, incredible man. He actually I was signposted to him by Rona, it was great. And he says he has a thing called the eraser test. So the eraser test is if you think of, like, if you guys think right now something that's really bad that's happened to you in the past, right? Sorry to bring the mood down a little bit, but it's an important point to make. If you think of something that's really bad that's happened to you in the past where you felt really stressed from an event, would you erase that moment in time? Would you, if you were going to erase that moment in time, everything that surpassed afterwards because of that event would have to be erased as well. And if you were to ask loads of people, they did a study on it, and apparently 99% of people wouldn't. And we're talking, you know, people who have had the most traumatic things happen to them. They wouldn't change it because it shapes you to who you are today. It makes you stronger. It strengthens your mind. It's stuff that, you know, we take for granted. At the time, it seems like the worst thing. But actually, like I mentioned before, it always works out. It always works out.
I think you're right. The easy answer is, of course, you'd erase it. Why would you want the pain? But, you know, we talk a lot about resilience and how we have to build resilience and what resilience is. But resilience is only experiencing things that don't go particularly well. And you learn how to cope with it and you move forward and you end up with a thicker skin or a better armor or whatever is required.
And you learn, don't you?
Well, yeah. But if you never go through the crap, you're never going to build resilience. And, you know, lots of people, particularly kind of, you know, younger parents of today, some of them perhaps, you know, cosset their kids too much and don't allow them to have these micro fails where they can actually learn.
Or even fall over.
Resilience. Yeah. There's too much comfort around people. So when they then become young adults, they don't quite know how to cope in different situations.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, for you, that kind of not submitting your VT places was a massive learning. And that would have changed your accuracy and how you plan and go about things and your attention to detail will be different as a result of that experience. I guarantee you.
Don't do that again. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. Like you say, it's resilience is massive. Resilience is huge in dentistry. It's huge in, any business. And without being tested, how can you build on it? You can't.
Mm.
So rather than kind of shy away from these things and try and create a barrier against what we perceive as negative things, we should take them on the chin and learn from them and grow from them, because that's the only way we're ever going to evolve our skill set anyway.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dentology, where we discuss the business of dentistry. If you like what you heard, please do subscribe where you found this episode. That would be amazing. And also follow us on Instagram.